Good evening, and welcome to Meditation 101 with Venerable Robina Curtin. We're so glad that you're able to be here and experience this really amazing teacher. I have just a couple of quick announcements to make. First of all, if you are a regular at Kadampa Center, you would be accustomed to when the teacher enters the room, we stand out of respect for the teacher and the teachings that she holds. And then generally with Geshe Gelug, when he prostrates to the altar, we prostrate with him. This is at his request, out of his humility. However, traditionally, the students wait until the teacher is seated and then prostrate. So that's what we'll be doing tonight. Anybody who's not comfortable with prostrations, that's okay. No need, it's not a requirement. You don't need to do that. I also wanted to let you know about a couple of pilgrimages that Venerable Robina will be leading later this year in Asia. In June, she will be doing a retreat at the Borobudur Temple in Indonesia. It's a 9th century Buddhist temple, and that is a 5-day retreat. Karen's not here, but one of our members has been on that retreat and found it quite amazing. If you'd like an even longer experience, in October and November, she will be leading a pilgrimage in India and Nepal. You visit a lot of amazing Buddhist holy sites. You go to Lumbini, where the Buddha was born, to Srivasti, where he and his disciples would spend the rainy seasons in retreat. It's quite amazing to know that you're walking on the ground that he walked on, to Kushinagar, where he passed away, to Vulture Peak, where he gave the teaching on emptiness. It's really an amazing pilgrimage. I've been on it. It's life-changing. So there are, if you are interested in finding out more, no need to make a commitment at this time. There are postcards out in the lobby right across from the doorway, and there's a little sign-up sheet that if you sign up and you want more information, we'll get that information to Effie, who signs you up for those. After tonight, Venerable Robina will be teaching tomorrow and Thursday on self-forgiveness, compassion, and purification. So that should be quite an amazing experience. And then on the weekend, she'll be teaching a weekend workshop Friday, Saturday, and Sunday on how to enjoy death, which is something we can't conceive of very well in the West, but she'll be teaching that. I also wanted to remind you that, as you're aware, we don't, at Kadampa Center, we have a tradition, we never charge for the Dharma. These teachings are too precious to have money ever be an obstacle to somebody receiving them. However, we do have expenses in bringing Venerable Robina here. So after you've had an experience of her, if you are moved in your heart to make a donation to help defray those expenses, we would be very happy. We have donation boxes. There's one directly outside the Gampa door and one right inside the center door. And there's also opportunities online to sponsor her teachings. And if you sponsor, you can also offer a dedication that will be shared with all of us on the evening of the day that you're sponsoring. That's all. Thank you.
All right. Hope I can see you all. If I can't see you, get chairs so I can move around so I can see you. I keep saying it, but you always have the lower chairs in the back. I wish you'd put the lower chairs in the front. The red ones seem to be high, you see. Whoever organizes the room, please, next time. You know, I'm always anxious about... I can't see Leonard, and I can't see David.
David, you can come on.
I can't see you guys. If you'd rather sit in the back, it's okay. You can stay hidden. It's all right. So let's do our little... do you do prayers and everything? We do prayers? Do we do prayers?
I don't know.
David, do we do prayers?
Not typically.
Okay, good. We won't do prayers then. I'll just start with a little motivation. Okay? So just think. Okay, we're sitting here. What for? you know, maybe curious, maybe listen to some of these ideas coming from the Buddha. Why? To take some tools from it. This has got to, it's got to be practical. In other words, if this were cooking class, you'd be very disappointed if I just raved on about how nice cakes are for 90 minutes and didn't give you even one recipe, okay? So have your ear open for recipes. And the recipe is to use in your life to do what? Well, to develop what for the Buddha is our amazing potential. For our sake, and then indeed, because we all live together in this crazy world, for the sake of others as well. The bottom line is that. So have that type of listening to anything here. And you might listen and you might not like one single thing, and that is perfectly fine. You don't need to like it. You don't need to use any of these tools. You're the boss here. And that's really important to think like that, okay? So with that in mind, I'm still going to sing a little prayer for those who want it. Taking refuge in generating bodhicitta for those who want it. And otherwise, you just sit and relax. Sangye chodang soke chok nam la jang cho badu dagni kyab su chi dagi chonyen gipe sonam ki dro la penche sangye dropa shog sangye chodang soke chok nam la jang cho badu dagni kyab su chi dagi chonyen gipe sonam ki dro la penche sangye dropa shog Sangye charang soke chok nam la chang cho baru dagni kyab su chi Dagi chonyen gipe sonam ki Dro la penche sangye drupa shog. Okay, well, David drove me here, so he gave me the heads up on what you've been talking about so far. So let's just kind of recap a few of the ideas, okay? So I think in our culture, you know, when we hear the word meditate, probably everybody you ask would have a slightly different definition. But I think one of the commonest things we think it's all about is to calm the mind down, or to make all the thoughts go away, or to make us feel better, you know? I think that's probably the simplest kind of maybe cliched idea we have of meditation. And then you think of a person meditating and you imagine them sitting quietly, usually cross-legged, and then sort of being holy a little bit, you know. And that's okay. I mean, that's better than nothing. It's better than wanting to kill somebody, isn't it? Much better. But so what is, let's just look freshly then, and what, you know, in the context of Buddhism, and certainly the Buddhism that we're discussing in this, that drives this center, which is the Buddhism that's been taught in Tibet. As we know, Buddhism's taught in Japan, in Thailand, over the centuries, mostly Asia, and now, of course, the last 50 years, especially in, you know, America, Australia, European countries, etc. So the Tibetan tradition, you know, it's got the bigger picture, Tibetan tradition. It's got this big, strong tradition of this monastic university system where people, like especially little boys and now these days little girls as well, enter into the university, this university system, and be there for 20, 30 years. And so it's real big emphasis on studying all the Buddhist views about the universe, the Buddhist world, the Buddhist views. And then traditionally what they would do after 20, 30 years of study, they would then, during the period, they'd be using meditation, quote unquote. But then many of them would go off seriously and now engage in serious meditation to internalize all that information they've been listening to. That's one attitude. So then that kind of gets us confused because we think, well, what's that got to do with calming the mind down? So let's look then maybe freshly, certainly the Tibetan, look at the meaning of meditation, the kind of classical meaning of meditation in this tradition of Buddhism, and therefore the use of it, okay, the purpose of it. Well, to understand, but before we even do that, we have to reiterate some of the points that we certainly talked about yesterday and that we, some of us know if we've listened to Buddhist teachings. We have to look at what the mind is, because what meditates is called the mind. The mind is what meditates. Buddhism doesn't use the word like soul or spirit at all, you know, because his view of the mind incorporates what you might like to call your soul or your spirit, you know, something more subtle, more mysterious in there somewhere. But Buddhism doesn't use that word at all. So the word, it's what's fascinating already though too, and stops us in our tracks when we try to get our head around the meaning of meditation, is if we listen to the Tibetan word for the verb to meditate. It's quite surprising. It's the word in Tibet, the Tibetan language, the word is gom, and it's the verb that's literally to become familiar, to familiarize. That's the meaning of the word, to meditate. Now, that's not how we think of it at all, is it? That kind of throws us a bit. So the... And then you go, well, familiarize what with what, please? And the answer is to familiarize your mind with two things. That which is accurate or true, or that which is the facts, and that which is virtuous. That's probably the best answer to give if you want the Tibetan Buddhist view of what meditation is, which of course immediately tells you its purpose. So then, okay, that seems puzzling to us as well. So what does that mean? Why would we need to meditate? Why would we need to familiarize ourselves with that which is true? Maybe that which is virtuous. That sounds reasonable. So then we've got to be checking what virtuous means. Well, virtuous is another word for being ethical, being a good person. You know, familiar. So that maybe seems reasonable. Familiarizing yourself with not being angry, with not being jealous, with not being depressed, with not having low self-esteem, with not lying, not killing, not stealing, etc., etc., etc. And then indeed, familiarize your mind with being loving and kind and compassionate. Now that even makes sense to us. But that's a little bit, sounds like a bit holy perhaps. But that would be reasonable, I think. Because if you say to yourself you want to meditate because you want to calm down and that also sounds a bit like wanting to familiarize your mind with being a virtuous person. And that, maybe that seems reasonable. But the other one, that which is true, that sounds a bit peculiar, you know. So to understand that, we have to understand then what Buddha's saying, Buddha's trip, basically. Buddha's trip is... What this Mr. Buddha, this man from 2,500 years ago, who came out of this amazing Indian tradition, who were actually the ones who invented this extraordinary technique that we know these days as mindfulness meditation, which is one of the techniques you've been learning about, which is one of the central techniques in Buddhism. They're the ones who invented this, these remarkable beings more than 3,000 years ago, and out of this tradition, that was where Buddha came from, and he took this technique and indeed other philosophical things and then went in his own direction in terms of his own findings about how things exist and blah blah blah. So one of the key points for the Buddha is why we need to meditate in the end is because we've got this crazy mind. Now we know that. We get depressed, we get angry, we get jealous, we get confused, we have panic attacks, we get anxious, we can't control the crazy thoughts. This we are really beginning to see, and this is what would often drive us to even want to meditate, you know? So fine, so far Buddha would agree with this. So his deal, Buddha's deal in the long term is that he has found from his own experience that this mind of ours, you know, this consciousness of ours, and he doesn't mean just the thoughts. He includes in that word all our thoughts and feelings and unconscious and subconscious. They've got a much, much more radical view of what the mind is in Buddhism. So Buddha's view of, he has found from his own experience using this particular technique that the Hindus invented, which we call mindfulness meditation, which is a marvelous skill that enables us to focus the mind to extraordinary subtle degrees. He has found that using this, and indeed many other, all these other philosophical approaches, that we are capable, every human being is capable, we have the potential to completely rid the mind of all the nonsense, all the rubbish, all the fears, all the voices of ego, as I like to call them, all this anger and worries and jealousy and depression and nonsense. In other words, all the stuff that for Buddha is the source of our suffering. And one of the interesting things about these states of mind, they're not only deeply disturbing, and that part we know about, which is why we want to calm down, but this is his point. He says they're a load of rubbish, they're liars, they're misconceptions. One of the words they use is they're delusions. So we, you know, if you were here last night, we talked about this. One of the key functions of these unhappy emotions, which is a big surprise to us, because we call them emotions, is that they've got this conceptual, they're rooted in this much deeper level of our being, where when we start to really become familiar with our mind, utilizing these skillful concentration meditation techniques, we can really begin to hear how anger and jealousy and all the dramas are rooted in really ridiculous, distorted, exaggerated conceptual dramas, conceptual stories that our minds have made up. over a long period of time. So so the long term for the Buddha is quite radical. His view of where we can really go with all this stuff is way more radical than we could ever think. 99% of us won't go in this life to the level he says we can, but that's the big picture from the Buddha's point of view. What he says is we've all got this potential to achieve nirvana. Now that is not a place like heaven. You achieve that in this body. It's basically, simply speaking, roughly speaking, you could say you've achieved your nirvana when you have quit all this nonsense in the mind, when you have rid your mind of all the neuroses, all the ego and all the neuroses, and what would be left in your mind, what would be left would be clarity, wisdom, you're in sync with reality, there's no longer disconnect between you and the way the world is, and you'd be joyful, you'd be compassionate, you'd be kind, you'd be all this stuff. Because Buddha says that's the stuff that's at the core of our being, and that the long-term purpose of all of these techniques is to become completely spontaneously familiar with all of that stuff. Because that, he says, is who we really are. That's like the sort of the small version of the bigger picture. So therefore the purpose of utilizing these marvelous psychological skills that are called meditation. So you can say in Buddhism, as I'm sure you've been hearing from David, is that there are two main modes of meditating, two main ways of using your mind in meditation. Because remember, your body does not meditate. We get very caught up in the physical, you know. If we sit down one morning and we feel very nice and comfy in the body as well as in the mind, we think we had a good meditation. But the body is really a drag. The body actually is an interference. The body's in the way. And of course it's been found, as you've been learning, there are nice ways to sit that all these great meditators over the centuries have found to be most conducive for enabling the mind to do this marvelous job of focusing and then of fixing itself and familiarizing itself with virtue and truth. Virtue and reality, basically. So it's the mind that meditates, the mind that meditates, the mind that meditates. There are two main modes of it. Thousands of techniques. But so the first one, okay, so in our tradition we learn these later on in the more advanced stages of the teachings. You know, there's a nice analogy I always like to use, that a bird needs two wings, wisdom and compassion. So all the practices and techniques and studies and things that a Buddhist would do, they all fit into these two wings. And the earlier stages of all the work, like junior school and high school, I like to call it, are in the wisdom wing. And then university is like the compassion wing, where you're learning to really familiarize your mind ridding your mind of deeper levels of all the rubbish that actually are the barriers between self and other, and then really familiarizing one's mind with empathy with others, compassion, love, empathy, and the ability to benefit others. Amazing. Using these same techniques to help us do that. And then this is where we really seriously learn about these two ways to meditate. Actually, the first mode is called, in terms of its result, it's known classically as calm abiding. Now, this technique is not even Buddhist. It actually came from these amazing Hindus, you know. Of course, they're happy to share it. Buddha took this technique and moved in his own direction, you know. And this is the one that people who talk about mindfulness, that's based upon this technique. And basically, it's a skill that enables us to focus. It's a concentration skill. And I like to say, and I mean it seriously, a communist could do this one. It's not religious in any form at all. It's a really rigorous, extraordinary, disciplined skill that most of us won't accomplish to the degree that Buddha says we can in this life. It's way more subtle than we could ever imagine, you know. But it's a marvelous technique. Everybody could benefit from it. But on its own, it's not enough, you know. On its own, it's not enough. Often it's known as mindfulness. This is one of the many states of mind that are crucial that we need to cultivate to enable us to do this job properly. And there's even these days we know almost like a technique, a whole system that has developed that incorporates other components of Buddhism that's known as mindfulness. But as Lama Zopa likes to point out, thieves need mindfulness as well. It's not in its nature virtuous, technically speaking. It's just simply, in fact, the word mindfulness is actually, technically speaking, is referring to one part of our mind, which literally is the capacity to not forget what you're doing. Well, indeed, thieves need that. We all need that to function, to do anything, good or bad, every day. So in its nature, that particular part of our mind is not virtuous or non-virtuous. What's known broadly as mindfulness meditation is mixed with other components, you know? So there's, the first one is known as calm abiding. And that's the name of the result. So a person who would have accomplished that, that's really advanced. That person, you know, they've accessed subtler levels of their mind that we don't even posit as existing in our materialist world. And again, I said the vast majority of us won't accomplish that. But we can learn that technique. We can start that, absolutely. And any of the focusing on your breath that you've been doing, that's this technique. So for the Buddha, that's just the starting point. The Hindus perfected this one, and the Buddha, again, like I said, took this. But for the Buddha, doing the Buddha's job of familiarizing your mind with that which is facts and that which is virtuous, or that which is moral, or that which is ethical, you know, is a crucial technique. But we might not ever really develop great advanced levels of it, but we can get enormous benefit almost immediately from it. And I'll explain, okay. So the first one is known as calm abiding, and that's literally another word you can say. It's called concentration meditation. Calm abiding is the name of this really subtle level of focus where the mind is effortlessly, I mean, again, at subtler levels, we don't even posit, but forget that, but effortlessly focused. And it's got extraordinary, the person who's accomplished this has got extraordinary qualities. We won't even discuss that. No need. But the second one is very interesting. It's known simply as insight meditation. And there's many methods for accomplishing this. So traditionally, though, the classical way in our tradition, the way we would use these two meditations, and this is where it's sort of a bit of a surprise to us because it doesn't fit what we think of as meditation at all. But this is the way we use it in our tradition. So, okay, let me use an ordinary example. Oh yeah, okay, let me use an ordinary example. Let's say you go to school. I went to school and I learned that 1 + 1 = 2. Now when I heard that information, obviously it was the first time I heard it, you know. And then my teacher at that point, I went to the convent, but it was Miss Holton who taught me. I always remember Miss Holton. She always smelt very lovely and wore bright red lipstick. I remember this. She used to hug me, so she had me for life, right? Because she hugged me, didn't she? So I remember Miss Holton very well. So she would have told me when I was 5 years old or whatever that 1 + 1 = 2. And then she would have probably said to me, go home and do your homework, Robina. Now, if she'd been a Buddhist, she would have said, go home, Robina, get some single point of concentration, and then go to your second mode of meditation, and I want you to get some insight into this, please. This is what she would have said. So when we hear, and you're going to listen to what I'm saying, and you'll understand exactly what I'm talking about. Okay, so I went home and did my homework, if I did do my homework, which I never did. So we all know if you do your homework, what you've got to do, you've got to get some focus. Well, she doesn't say, go and get some single point of concentration. But we know if you can't focus, well, forget it, you can't do your homework. If you can't center your mind, and that means, you know, close the door, be at your desk and get your pencil and get ready, get some focus first. Pretty obvious. You've got to get some focus first. Then, to the degree that you have any focus at all, what I would have done is gone to the second mode of meditation, and the goal would have been to do what? To get insight into the fact that 1 + 1 = 2. Wouldn't you agree with that? And in English, insight's a lovely word. In many other languages, I notice there's really weird, religious, strange, mystical words they use for this insight, which makes us mystify this stuff. But actually, it's really, really practical. So the goal is, as you can see, to get insight into the fact that 1 + 1 = 2. In other words, to understand it, to put it inside my head, to know the meaning, to understand it. That's the meaning of the word insight. Think very simply. It means to get it, to understand it. Now, this is the point. What method would I have used to get an insight into the fact that 1 + 1 = 2? Well, probably I would have used the process called thinking. Do you not agree with that? I would have probably thought about it. If I focused, then I would have got my pencil or I've got my blocks and then I would have worked it out, wouldn't I? Now, first of all, though, this is an interesting point. I would have had to have the facts clear. I'd have to know what 1 is. I'd have to know what 2 is. I'd have to know what plus means. And I'd have to know what equals means. There's quite a bit of information there to put together for a little 5-year-old, isn't it? So I would have had to use my noggin, wouldn't I? Now, if I could never focus for more than a half a second, there's no way I could get any insight into it, is there? It's pretty obvious, isn't it? So you've got to have the focus, and then I'd have to use what they call in Tibetan Buddhism, the method we've used, and David would have taught you about it. It's called analytical meditation. You've heard of that phrase, right? Well, I don't want to make you disappointed. That's a nice medieval phrase that for what we would use for the verb to think about. Okay? That's all it means. Don't think it means anything else. I know when I first heard about analytical meditation, I'd go, oh, wow, what's that? You know, completely confused. And when we say it, we get confused. But it just means to think about it. So this is very disappointing because you didn't think that meditating was thinking about something, did we? So this is where really we've got to get clear in this particular system what it's for. The focus is only, in the calm-abiding meditation, if you accomplish that, even if you accomplish a little bit of that, it would have phenomenal, marvelous results for you. It would calm your mind down. You'd feel really joyful. You'd be really clear with your thoughts. You'd be extraordinary. Just the benefit of a little bit of calm-abiding is remarkable. And we'll talk more about this in a minute. But the purpose in the Buddhist tradition, on its own, it just brings nice feelings. Very happy. I'm happy for you. But that's not the purpose. The purpose is to get your mind focused so you can do the second mode where you're going to think through things. So this gets us, of course, to Buddha's view about how, right now, all of our unhappy emotions have the experience of being disturbing, but they've got this other characteristic of being liars, of being misconceptions, of being delusional. So a simple way of talking of the use of these two modes of meditation, using it if you're a Buddhist in this tradition, but we can equally use these, and that's what I'm getting to now, in our daily life. If you're not a Buddhist, this is my point here, I'm getting to this. You've got to have some focus. And in the second mode, you would, like if you're a Buddhist, you've been to a class, say, about karma, the Buddhist philosophical view about karma. You've heard it, you've got your notes, but you've got to internalize it. We all know you've got to do your homework. If you don't learn your mathematics, you won't pass your exam. If you don't memorize your musical stuff, you won't pass your violin exam. We all know we've got to do homework, which means we've got to memorize it. We've got to put it inside our head, don't we? Not just hear it superficially. So the same here. So the Buddha says, Rabina, you know, for example, you use it simply. Let's say, I get angry. Let's say I get angry. And that means I get disturbed and I make up all these ridiculous stories. You're a monster. You're the cause of all my suffering. How dare you do that? You're evil. You're blah. You're this and you're that. He says, calm down. Go home. Get a bit of focus. Go to the second mode of meditation and think through the problem. This is how you use it in daily life. You'd think through the problem. Well, he said this and I said that. And what is this and therefore this? You'd try and use your common sense. You'd use your noggin. You'd use an analysis based on some focus to sort out your problem. Now, this is called life. We do this all the time. It's just that this is... What? Sorry. What happened?
I want to solve a problem for someone. If you have a white Volvo, BJA4698, park next door, your lights are on. Thank you.
Okay, good. Very good. Sorry. Sorry, Donna. I'm glad you leapt in there. Nobody's responding. So maybe it doesn't belong here, you mean?
Maybe not.
Okay.
Okay, good.
Have I been talking too quickly? Are you following me?
Yes.
Are you following me?
Yes.
Okay, good. So, traditionally in Buddhism, forget the anger bit, I would have gone to my class, or like mathematics, and I would go home, I'd get some focus, and then I would think through what I learned in the class so it can go from my head to my heart. And that's what an insight is. I'd go, oh, I get it. Just like my 1 + 1 = 2. Just like whatever it is you're learning violin. And just like here, learning about karma. This is the use of it in this tradition. And of course, it's where you should internalize it, and then you've memorized it. And then, of course, when you've memorized it, you can then apply it in daily life. If you've gone to mathematics class, but you never memorize it, you never internalize it, you never get any insight into it, then someone, mummy says, go to the market and buy 5 oranges, you won't know what 5 oranges is, will you? You'll be in trouble. And then you have to carry your little book, your book around, or your calculator, and work out what 5 is. But it's a lot easier if you do your insight, think it through, and it becomes an insight. Now you know what 5 is. Well, that's an insight. Don't romanticize an insight. Don't mystify an insight. It's just what they use in Buddhist language. But the trouble is, as soon as it's Buddhism, we lose the plot. You know, insight just means understanding something. Don't make it fancy. Of course, there are levels of insight, no doubt about that. So don't mystify it. You know, it just means get some focus, think through what you've heard, which is merely intellectual in the beginning, just like the numbers. And then the more you think about it, which is analytical meditation, and of course, the more sophisticated your skill, your focus is, the more sophisticated your analysis, there's no question. And in the long term, when we get to things like we talked about last night, like emptiness, you really need powerful, deep focus, and you need extraordinary capacity for really, really sophisticated analysis, you know. You just keep getting better at these two. But this is the method that you learn to become a violinist, a cook, a mathematician, or a Buddha. And I really sincerely mean this. Just a minute, wait.
Okay.
Keep your question. Are we communicating here?
Yes.
Now, maybe if you only heard about meditation, it mightn't make much sense what I'm saying. Am I confusing you? Anybody's confused? Oh, good. So what's your question?
So I... Please use the...
Yep. I want to have insight and I want...
Into what, though?
Say that again?
Into what, darling?
I want to have insight into meditation. I want to...
Oh, no, wait a minute. What do you mean? I'm not talking about insight into meditation.
Like, I just want to have general insight, like 2 plus 2 is 4. So I want to have...
Okay, I'm not trying to stop you in your tracks, but I am stopping you in your tracks. I want to know what you think you mean when you say you want to get insight. Are you... go on, keep talking.
Insight into so that I lead a better life, so that I'm more relaxed, so
good.
That I can do meditation and...
So what do you want in, so based on what you've just heard me say, what's the insight you want?
I want the insight that you have. I want the insight that
I don't have any, come on. So okay. So what's your question?
So my question is, but I don't have the patience that I... How do I have the patience so that I do the hard work? I don't have the patience.
Is that a serious question?
Yes, because if I...
No, is that a serious... You're really serious?
Yes.
Have you learned anything in your life?
Yes.
What have you learned? What's your skill?
Little bit of computer science.
What, darling?
Little bit of computer
science. A little bit?
Yeah.
A little bit. You've learned it?
Yes.
You've learned to walk, talk, add, drive, speak. You've learned lots of things, wouldn't you say?
Yes.
And have you learned things that are difficult? You've stretched yourself to learn things that are difficult?
Yes, and sometimes I'm very bad in meditation. I'm
not discussing meditation. Please keep away from that. I'm asking you practical questions here. Have you ever learned anything in your life? Have you studied hard at some things? Really studied hard and passed exams and done jobs that have, as a result of learning those things? Have you done that?
Yes.
So you have actually been able to learn things that you didn't know how to do?
Yes.
You had the patience to do it?
Yes.
Well, then you know the answer yourself.
Yes, and in this...
No, you know the answer then.
Partly, because in this case, I am running out of patience. If I do meditation, I have shortness of breath, so I feel dizzy and I have headache.
What's this meditation you're doing, please?
Just focusing on breath.
Well, then stop focusing on the breath if it makes you anxious. Relax. Don't do it. What are you doing it for?
Just to feel better.
Well, then don't bother. Go have an ice cream, honey, and have good sex or something.
Okay. I wanted to do the meditation, but that's okay. Thank you.
No, I haven't finished yet.
Okay.
I'm just a bit shocked what you're saying, that's all. What do you mean you want to feel better? That's exactly why bother sitting with your legs crossed and your eyes closed and you want to feel better? I'm sure you're pulling
because
me up.
My mind races, there are many thoughts.
Okay, stop right there. Okay, stop right there. Okay. It's excellent that you've noticed that your mind races. The vast majority of humans on this earth have absolutely no idea that what goes on in their mind plays any role at all in their lives. So you are already way ahead of the game, darling, and I rejoice hugely. And you've actually noticed your mind is racing. They say one of the first signs of success in the concentration meditation technique, and described in the text in terms of 9 stages, one of the first signs of success, and even the first of the 9, is you think you're getting worse. So, honey, you're making progress. At least you know you have a mind. At least you've searched out techniques to calm your mind down because you recognize it's distressing. And you've noticed your mind's racing. Well, then join the universe, okay? What's special? So then why... your mistake is not... that your mind is racing. Your mistake is having this bizarre expectation that you should have stopped racing your mind by now.
Not by now, at least maybe in future because...
Sorry, what?
Not by
what
now.
What do you mean by future? What are you talking about?
Like maybe in 1 month or 6 months so I feel better because it's not good to always have a racing mind.
Okay, you're living in a fantasy land.
Okay.
A friend of mine was in New York and went for 1 year to do a retreat in one of these retreat centers in France where people do intensive 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 5 year, 20 year retreats. And using these techniques, including others. And she went back after 1 year to New York and said, "Rabina, I had to go back. I had just begun to see my mind." Then she did a second year and a third year. So, sweetheart, your mistake is your insane, bizarre, nonsense expectations. Did you hear my words? Because this is my advice to you. Did you hear my words? Have you really heard my words?
Yes.
Your mistake is not that you can't calm your mind down. Your mistake is that you expect that you should have done better than you've done. That is your mistake, sweetheart. So if you change that expectation, you will really do beautifully.
Yes, and I can interpret it, and I think you will agree. I think it's like if I'm running to race, if I'm expecting to win, that's wrong. But if I just continue running race and doing better, I'll be fine.
So if you know the answer, why are you asking me? You seem
so... Now I know the answer.
Well, thank you. So really, honey, this is the biggest mistake everybody makes. People have been studying for practicing for 30 years, say this.
I have one last question.
Darling, you're not listening to me. You're so rushing to get your head out. Can you just listen to my... If you want to hear my advice, maybe it's a lot of rubbish advice. Let me say it to you. And I'd like you to think about it.
Okay, I will.
I haven't finished yet. I'm trying to give space so I can have your ears listen. Listen, sweetheart. Many people I know, who've been practicing, let's say, for 30 years, say exactly the same as you. Because, you know why? Because when we start to see our neurotic ego, it's addicted to misery. Your ego, like the rest of us, is addicted to seeing the bad. All you notice is the bad. If you looked freshly at yourself and did a little bit of comparison, with, like I said this last night to somebody else, if you did a bit of comparison with other people on this suffering, suffering earth, you would be weeping every day with delight and joy in your virtue and your goodness and your wish to be a better human being. But you're not noticing that. All you're noticing is what you haven't achieved. So we need a bit of perspective. So you have a... So let me ask you a few questions. Like the fellow last night, you weren't here for that. Do you kill?
No.
Do you lie?
Sometimes.
Do you steal?
No.
Do you rape people?
No.
Are you a terrorist?
No.
Okay, you're doing pretty well then. Do you have a wish to be a better person?
Yes.
And you try to be moral?
Yes.
Then, sweetheart, you should be crying, and I mean this from the depths of my heart. You should be delighted in joy that you are such a good person with access to your virtue and the wish to make yourself a better person. So have some humility with yourself. Try and see the good things about yourself. Have a long-term view about it and you will work beautifully and be happy with your progress.
Thank you.
Each step of the way, darling, I beg you.
Yes, and you gave me a new perspective and I want to thank you personally, but I can't write the personal stuff in front of everybody, so I will send you a letter.
You do that. We can talk.
And I have one more wish. Like, would
right,
you be
sweetheart.
Able to
bit closer to the mic, sweetheart.
Would you be able to bless me after the...
I can't bless anybody, but we can have a little chat.
Okay, thank
Come
you.
Come and see me later.
Thank you.
All right, darling. Thank you. What's your name?
Pavitra.
Okay, we'll talk later. Thank you, sweetheart. Anybody else? Have a conversation with me. But it's a big point, isn't it? We all feel the same. We are all, it's kind of utterly fascinating. And this is pointing to the Buddha's view about the irony of ego, is that we're just junkies for misery, you know. We're junkies for how bad we are. And it's good to see how bad we are, but we've got to balance it with how good we are and then get some perspective and a bit more humility and patience about our goals. And but we're all the same. I really mean it. It's utterly fascinating. But we're communicating a bit. It's such a good point you made. Really it is, sweetheart. Anybody else? Any questions? So far. Oh, we just began talking, okay? But are there any questions that you would like me to go further? I mean, there's lots more we have to say about meditation. But any more questions about what I've said so far? Okay, fine. Okay, so if you don't even... So let's say this is now to somebody who, say, doesn't want to become a Buddhist, and that's perfectly fine. And this is where, even if you are a Buddhist or not a Buddhist, this is the application of these two modes of meditation in daily life. These two ways of using your mind. Get some... You know, at the end of the day, first of all, begin the day with something. It's nothing better than that. You start the day, even with 3 or 4 minutes, you sitting, focusing your mind, and making a few... kind of like having a few goals for the day. You know, just focus for a couple of minutes, like you've been learning, on your breath. And then just think, I'm going to make the most of today. I'm not going to try and, I'll try and avoid shooting my mouth off. I'll try and avoid, you know, doing too many ridiculous things with my body and speech. And I'll make the most to attempt to see what I'm thinking throughout the day. And then at the end of the day, you take stock before you go to sleep. You take stock. You check when you did bad mouth that person. You did curse this one. You did scream at the car. You said this and did that. Little baby things, whatever you did do, you know. And then you kind of, you can just then think, I regret doing that because it's really dumb for my own mind. I'm sorry I hurt other people. You'll do a bit of focus and you go to bed with a happy mind, you know. This is a simple, simple way of applying, the most humble, simple way of applying these skills. All they are just ways to use our minds skillfully and wisely for our benefit. And then, of course, for the benefit of those others we have contact with in daily life, you know. So obviously in Buddhism, there are far more techniques we can do utilizing these skills, you know. The first one is concentration. There are many ways you can learn that, and you've been learning some things from David. There's many things to focus on. But remember the point of that, in spite of the point here, it isn't just to calm the mind. As long as we keep thinking, I've got to calm my mind down, we will definitely be distressed, because it will not happen that you will calm your mind down necessarily. Some people have an ability to sit down quietly and relax and their mind seems calm, you know, but even that is not necessarily a sign of success. And the trouble is here, we're such junkies for good feelings, we can't bear it when we have bad feelings. But the longer term approach to this concentration one is to see it as a training. You've got to see it as a training. You've got to see it in long term. We absolutely have to, you know. And that means, you see, for most of us, we won't get concentration in this life. Forget it. But almost immediate benefit, and I think I mentioned this yesterday, I'm not sure. The most immediate benefit will be that because you're sitting for 2 or 3 minutes in the morning, 5 minutes in the morning, whatever, and you're focusing on one thing like your breath, what you're doing when you're focusing on your breath is you're using strong determination to not follow every thought. But inevitably, you can't help but notice the thoughts. And in fact, you notice them even more because we've not paid attention before. So don't be disappointed about that. Be glad about that. And why should you be glad that you see your crazy thoughts? Because they are what are driving us underneath, deep down, that we normally never notice until they come vomiting out the mouth. Or until you can't get up one morning because you're so depressed. And that is too late. So this skill, what it's doing, which enables us to focus, but also enables us to hear the crazy thoughts, and you've got to be glad to hear the crazy thoughts. So why? So that in daily life, you bring this skill to bear, so that when you're driving the car, normally you wouldn't be at all even aware of what you're thinking, and then the car leaps in front of you and you have a panic attack. Scream and shout and yell. But this time, because you're learning to be more aware, you can't help but also notice your thoughts, not just the car in front of you. And then you slowly every day get braver and braver because you're noticing all the stuff there. You learn to start, and this is where you're using the analysis. In a simple way, you're learning to think things through, to do a bit of discussion with yourself, to be your own therapist, is a simple way of putting what the second mode is. Because of focus, you're going to get to see your mind more clearly, and then you can start doing the analysis part while you're driving, while you're on the toilet, while you're doing the dishes, not just sitting on your cushion looking holy. You become more conscious of all these thought processes, and they're our thought processes, and if we don't learn to know them, who will? You know? So you need courage to do this. Because all of us have chaotic minds. Because why do we have chaotic minds? Because we've never tried and we don't have techniques in our culture to calm them down, to understand them, you know. And our trouble is, like I said, we don't notice them until you practically go crazy. And then you've got to rush to a therapist, you know. It's too late. It's too late. So this skill of focusing has a multitude of benefits. It enables us to hear more clearly. Be brave and want to hear your thoughts more clearly. And then you can do this more clear, thinking things through intelligently. Being your own therapist is a nice way that Lama Yeshe puts it. Meaning kind thinking with yourself. Normally we abuse ourselves. We don't do intelligent thinking about ourselves. It's always putting ourselves down or being depressed because no one likes us or it's not fair or poor me. It's very rarely intelligent analysis that we're doing about ourselves. The only time we tend to even have positive thoughts about ourselves are in this really unhappy defensive way, and we think, well, I'm really better than they think I am. That's not positive. So the second mode, thinking in a casual way, using it in a casual way in our daily life, sitting with yourself, being your own friend, not your own abuser, and thinking things through. We are so addicted to thinking we can't do it that we have to go speak to a friend, speak to our therapist. Nothing wrong. Have a good friend. Have a good therapist. We need people to help us hear our own thoughts. But eventually we can really do it ourselves and be kind of grown up. Normally now we've got to vomit it all out and sort it out with somebody because we can't cope, you know. But we can learn to do it ourselves. And that's the thing. This is a casual way of talking about these two modes. Thinking it through. Nothing unique, nothing special, but intelligently, kindly, wisely. A bit of tears is okay, it doesn't matter. Sit in your own cushion. Sit in your own chair and work something out. And then, you know, let's say you had a fight with somebody, your husband, or whoever, your child, the boss, I don't care. Instead of rushing to somebody else and vomiting all out and then reinforcing your rubbish, you sit down, you watch your breath for 2 minutes, you steady a little bit, and then you think it through intelligently, not panicked, not worried, not guiltily, kindly, wisely. What happened then? He did come home late. I know he's always late, but Rabina, you're so sensitive. It's really all right, sweetheart. Let him come home late. He does mean well. He really doesn't hate you. Don't exaggerate. You talk yourself like this, and before you know it, you're fine, and you walk out and you say, "Hi, darling, how are you?" The whole problem solved. This is what means being your own therapist. But it's got to be kind and wise, and we've got to have courage to do this. Because we can't cope, it's true, we can't cope with all the crazy thoughts. We panic when we see them. We don't need to panic, okay? It's okay. We've got to have a lot of courage to see our thoughts, to see our mind. Because we can, we have amazing potential to harness this energy. But it just takes time. The problem, like I'm saying here, is not that we have racing minds. The problem is we think we shouldn't, and we panic about it and can't stand it. And we want to do anything to make it go away. That's too frantic. This is too much to expect. We've got to have courage to see what we're thinking, to listen to it, and know it won't make us crazy. We can work things through, and we can change our thoughts, because no matter how emotional they are, they're still just thoughts. These words sound so simple, but they're profound, I tell you. Are we communicating here? Of course, in Buddhism, there's all these techniques that we need to use that seem seemingly quite abstract and even religious. That one, if one takes on Buddhism, that one uses to help us do this job better. But we've got to start somewhere, you know. You don't have to be called a Buddhist. You've got to have this real humility and courage and confidence to want to see your mind, to want to unpack and unravel your thoughts, to want to identify all the rubbish in there, and to want to identify the goodness. We forget about the goodness, like my point here. Because we can't stand the badness. We can't stand all the uncontrolled thoughts, you know. And it's reasonable, because they are berserk, most of us. But it's okay. We have to have courage. Is it making sense? What do you think? I mean, there's lots of formal ways of doing meditation. I'm not even talking about that here. But maybe I can mention just some techniques. I don't know. Maybe you have to ask me some more questions. Come on. Any old question. Don't get nervous. Come on. Somebody? What, darling?
Let's do a meditation and then maybe we come up with something.
What, sweetheart?
Let's do a meditation.
No! No? You do your own meditation. This is your job, not mine. Mine is to talk.
Okay.
You do the meditation. I'm not going to make you feel good, like giving you an ice cream, you know. We all love it's very nice to be led in meditation. It's because you want to feel nice. Excuse me, David can do it next week. Oh no, it's the last day, isn't it? Oh, I'm so sorry. What a disappointing ending. All right, I might end with one, all right? I might end with a nice, quiet, soft meditation.
Something I struggle personally, I'm not sure if...
What's your question? Speak into the mic properly.
This is something I struggle with personally.
Yes.
It's about more how to learn to accept my life as it is rather than having the delusional thinking that it should have been or it will be like that.
Well, that's what we described before, isn't it? That's the problem, isn't it?
That's yes, right. But it's a big problem as I grow old because I'm expected to be married and have kids.
I understand. I know, darling. I understand it exactly. This is called, this is the one essential way of describing Buddha's skill in dealing with this one. Well, let's just, and that's really what the Buddha's teaching is almost a starting point. I understand. Okay. But let's just see what happens. I want to hear other questions first. Thank you, darling. Yes. Microphone, please. Yes.
You said that there were two main modes of meditation.
That's right.
And then you said that there were five techniques.
What?
Five techniques?
No. I never said that.
Okay.
I probably said many techniques. There are hundreds of techniques. In the second kind, there are many ways of doing the second mode of meditation, many ways of developing insight. Lots of techniques there. The first one in general is technique to how to concentrate.
Yeah.
The essential thing is to learn to focus. Yeah, there are many. So we do sort of the meditations we do in our tradition in the second mode, based upon good concentration. You'd go to the second mode, and then you would do this one that we call analysis, which is thinking things through, coming to some kind of conclusion about something to make it more experiential. And that would be classically in our Buddhist tradition. You'd hear a class like you would your violin music. Well, here you'd have your karma class. You'd go home and you'd think it through until it became more real in your heart. Do you understand? There's that kind. Then we have lots of visualization meditations. We do in the more esoteric teachings in Buddhism, we do visualizations of the Buddha where you visualize, and some people like these a lot. We might just, there's a certain kind that we do where you visualize the Buddha, you visualize light coming and purifying, and then you visualize, light coming and, it is also just using your thinking, but it's imagining things, which is very, very helpful. Do you understand? Lots of those. People really like those sometimes. And there's another kind we do. Oh, what was that? I forget. Something else I was going to say. Yeah, we have a whole, a lot of the meditations we do in the second mode, all the meditations we do in the second mode are where you're using your thinking. And this is where it's so surprising because we're so addicted to thinking this word meditation means not thinking. But that's only the first mode. The second mode is this approach of familiarizing your mind with it. That's the use of the word in Tibetan. So when we understand that's the meaning of the word meditate, it opens it up completely. So, in other words, the second mode of meditation is where you're learning to change the way you think, really. If you don't know music, you learn to think, you learn new thoughts, which are called musical thoughts, aren't they? And they're initially intellectual, wouldn't you agree? And then you practice piano every day, and then suddenly your head is full of so many musical thoughts now, and it's spontaneous. You can play the piano beautifully, can't you? Well, that's the second mode. That's where you develop insight into music, insight into cooking. And I'm using these examples purposely because we understand this approach. We call it learning something. You with me here? So all you're doing, if you're a Buddhist, you're learning about karma. You're learning about impermanence. You're learning about reincarnation. You're learning about the different Buddhist philosophical views, which are the views that I have chosen as a Buddhist to want to become familiar with. So they become my natural way of living. Do you see my point? So masses of hours are those. And the visualization ones are a similar idea. So we have, for example, a meditation where you visualize the Buddha of compassion. And the purpose is to develop more compassion. So you visualize light coming and purifying all your delusions. Then you visualize light coming and filling you with compassion for other people, So many of the meditations are like that. But it's the same principle. You're familiarizing your mind with a bunch of new thoughts. So if you do that every day, like with music, it becomes natural after a while, doesn't it? So this is the meditations we use to become more loving, to become less angry, to become more generous, to become more kind. You familiarize yourself by thinking about it until it gets deeper and deeper and deeper until it comes eventually spontaneous. Do you see what I'm saying? So it's not a mystical process at all. It's just, it does demand hard work, that's all. Are you communicating with me?
Thanks.
Yeah. Does that make sense, people? So it's not mystical. Don't see it as mystical, which is what we do. We have this, as soon as we hear spiritual, we lose all common sense. So I like to use ordinary examples. We meditate every day using the Buddhist meaning of the word. We familiarize our minds with the most amazing things every day. And then we become, including bad things. You familiarize with, you know, we talk about, it's very funny, we talk about how we, oh, I can't concentrate. She says, oh, I can't concentrate, we say. Or we say, oh, I can't visualize. It's a load of rubbish. Of course you can. Think, you know, it's maybe too much information, but if I think about when I was in love with a boy, I could have been in the middle of 50,000 people at the football, shouting. I didn't have to tell them to be quiet so I could concentrate. I had perfect concentration on my perfect fantasy of my new boyfriend, didn't I? So I had perfect visualization and perfect concentration. Do you agree with what I'm saying? When you are angry with somebody, you don't say to somebody, be quiet, I'm trying to meditate on anger. You know how to do it perfectly. Nobody will distract you, I promise. So you can never say you haven't got concentration, and you do not say you haven't got visualization. We do it perfectly every day, but it's anger and attachment and self-hate and jealousy and depression, because we're familiar with those, aren't we? So it's using skills we've already got, but to become familiar with boring old virtue. You understand? That's why it's hard. So you've got to be patient. Like she says, no patience. So to be patient with something and to persevere, you've got to know the benefits. Like, you know, you let's say you're 20 pounds, 30 pounds overweight with no muscle tone. And you go to the gym. Someone tells you you can look gorgeous if you go to the gym. Right? And you come home, you feel worse than the day than when you went, don't you? But you don't get depressed about it because you know the pain is good pain. That's the same here. Thinking you're getting worse when you start to meditate because you're now seeing the problems. And you have to remember the benefit. So if you forget the benefit of going to the gym, believe me, you'll give up after 2 days. That's why you've got to make effort. There's no shortcut. You've got to make effort. And this is what is difficult. We make effort to do the things we're attached to. We make supreme effort to get the things we want. We will never stop doing that. So we have to, again, remember that we've got the ability to persevere and be patient. But it's difficult because, you know, we have this tendency to be wanting to be in our comfort zone, you know. So it's got to take effort. You've got to know the benefit of it. And then you've got to just keep doing it every day. There's no shortcut, you know. There is no shortcut. Are we communicating? Yeah. What else? Come on, what else? Questions? Where are you? Yes, darling.
So, the first step of meditation, when you're concentrating and focusing, are we building that so that then we can choose in our second type of meditation to focus on certain thoughts and not just let our mind run random, but you're still thinking?
Not like
thinking
that, no. Not like that,
stuff.
No. It's not like that at all. Not like that at all, no. Not like that at all.
Okay.
In other traditions in Buddhism, there's all other kinds of vipassana or insight meditation. And I don't know those at all, so I can't tell you those. It's all about the sensations of your body, and there's a whole system of that, and I have no idea. I've never done those in my whole life, so I'm sorry, you have to ask somebody else about those. That's the traditional thing about concentration and what they call vipassana. And it's insight into different experiences of your body in order to develop the ability to know your own mind better, basically, to understand how things change, blah, blah, blah. So here I'm talking in a very casual way for a person who wouldn't be a Buddhist, let's say, how you use these two modes. So what I mean is this. This is my way of saying it, okay? You get some focus. Have you got family? Husbands, babies, grandmas, grandpas? So you all love each other, I'm sure, but no doubt if you're like the rest of us, you probably have a few dramas, right? Join the universe. Okay, it's okay. You don't need to be personal. So then, you have to work those out, don't you?
I've got a teenager. I have a daily
drama. Oh, well, a darling girl. You know all about it. So you have to work things out in your own head. And do you not do this all day? Are you not working in your own mind, sorting out what to say, what to do, when? We're doing this all about, this is called living life. So don't mystify this process. Okay, all I'm saying is this. If we can learn to do the single-pointed concentration at different times in the day, let's say, in the morning, start the day. It's good to start the day. Throughout the day, when you're on the toilet, need a bit of a break, go to lock the lavvy doors, we'd say in Australia, or whenever. The skill of that is, the goal is to get concentration, but don't think about that. One of the immediate benefits, as you must surely know, as she's pointing out, of when you sit there for a few minutes watching your breath, What you're doing is you're creating, what you're doing is you're having the determination not to just blindly follow the thoughts. Wouldn't you agree with that? So the immediate benefit is that you can't help but hear the thoughts. Wouldn't you agree with that? So that's not the, so the, that's got nothing to do with the thoughts here. There's no job here to do anything with those thoughts. I'm not caring about those thoughts. But it is interesting that we're going to see them, especially if you're having a drama. They're going to go nuts, aren't they? So you keep, never mind, let them be there, let them come and let them go. It's an amazing discipline. So the purpose of that is just to focus. But I would put it this way, one of the immediate byproducts of that is that you hear more clearly all your crazy thoughts. Again, I will say that. So far, so good, okay? Now, all I'm saying is, if you want to go to the second mode, and I'm talking in a casual way here, not a formal way that we talk about in our cult, in our Buddhism, you, because you've got more focus, you've got more ability to think through your problem without too much volatility, without too much disturbed emotion. You can be more calm and more clear in dealing in your own mind, thinking through your problem. That's all is, that's called analysis. Nothing cosmic about it. And then at some point, you will think it through and you'll come to a conclusion. Won't you? Do we not do this every day? All I'm saying is, this is life. But because our emotions are so fraught and there's so much drama around them, we can hardly do any clear thinking. And so then we don't know how to do it ourselves. We get too stressed and we have to go and vomit it out to our sister or the teenage daughter, and then it's all too late. Do you understand?
Thank you.
So this is a practical way of applying this idea of quote-unquote analytical meditation, or as Lama Yeshe puts it, being your own therapist. It's just you dealing with what you've got to deal with in your life. But the focus will give you more clarity and will help you steady a little bit. Or like the 9-round breathing, you do that first and it'll a little bit calm, and then you can think through your problem before it vomits out your mouth, and then you can think carefully how you deal with the problem. Am I making sense now? This is not a formal way of talking about in our culture, in the Buddhism. We do this formally about what we learned in class. Do you see what I'm saying? But this is a practical way to apply these techniques to daily life. Because the problem is here. We can see, can't we, that the problems, we have problems and they involve our body and our speech. So we mightn't go around shooting and raping too many people, right? But do we not use our speech? And is that not where 99% of our problems come from? It's the speech, isn't it? And why is our speech uncontrolled? Because we've never bothered to control our speech. And why do we not control? Because we can't bear that. We don't know what we're thinking. And everything just vomits out. And we all know once the word is out, the trouble is done. And we know that's the nightmare, especially family. It's heartbreaking. The schisms and dramas and divisions in families because of speech. So this is to help us get more clear in our own little minds and deal with that, be adult enough to deal with our drama in the chair before you explode out the door and scream at the daughter or scream at the husband uncontrolled. So then you can actually come to a little conclusion and do a bit of tears, it doesn't matter, but be grown up enough to know you don't have to vomit it all out. And you don't have to talk to somebody else necessarily. You can work it out yourself. And then you can conclude, and then you have controlled speech. This is already huge. Are we communicating here? This is a benefit that can come from just focusing on your breath for a few minutes. The goal of this is to get long concentration. We won't get it, don't worry about it. But we'll see our thoughts and be glad. And they'll know slowly that this explosion inside us, we can learn to harness it. We are big enough to work with it and begin to control our speech. So then 99% of our problems will be ceased, I promise you. That's what I mean by analysis. Nothing fancy. But it means you've got to be adult enough to feel grown up enough, adult enough that I can handle it. I can bear this. I can work it out, you know, in ourselves. It doesn't mean we shouldn't talk to somebody else and work it out. Great. But we can do it ourselves. But we've not learned this in our culture. We don't know how to see our feelings and our emotions. No wonder we have so many problems, you know. And the more we get focused, the more we see it, and then initially it's very painful because we think we're getting worse, and it's chaos, but slowly, slowly, with courage every day, using this skill to talk through things and then be skillful what we're going to say, you know. Do you understand?
Thank you again.
This is a real application day to day. Being your own therapist. Sorting it out yourself. But part of the problem, and this is the thing you're talking, And this is where we talk about attachment. You know, Buddhism talks about attachment. There's this cute word, attachment, but it's got profound, deep meaning. And basically it's this, you know, it's got multi, it's like we talked yesterday, it's got multifaceted. It's this deep sense of never being enough. Therefore, this deep feeling of always craving something that isn't there. The function of attachment is to always want something that isn't there. So the deepest way attachment is I'm never enough. I haven't got enough. And that means an addiction to seeing what's bad. An addiction to pointing our faults out. An addiction to being guilty, which means never happy with what we've done. Never happy with how much we've achieved. People, like I said, have been practicing 30 years. Oh, I'm still so angry. I'm still so depressed. They're not even noticing the progress they've done, you know. We are addicted. That's the terrible irony of ego. Ego doesn't necessarily mean you're a big, strong, arrogant person. Ego is self-pity. And when we can begin to hear this, it's heartbreaking. It's cruelty to ourselves. So slowly when we hear this and we're so addicted to this, we can start again talking to ourselves. And even just, it sounds so corny, it sounds like being Pollyanna. But even just saying a few positive thoughts to yourself. After your session, I didn't do so well, I'm a bit tense, but I'm doing okay. I have got potential. I know I can develop this. It is okay. I can do it. It's kind of like being kind to ourselves, people. Not being like a baby, getting ourselves off the hook, like children, you know, but being really genuinely kind. We're not used to doing that. And that gives us courage to know that we can deal with these things. It isn't unbearable. And most of us, we do find it unbearable because our thoughts are uncontrolled. But we can handle it, you know. It's like being grown up. Are we communicating? It takes time, though. I mean, all I know is when I was a kid, and up to when I was a kid, whatever, one of my biggest habits was anger. And I mean, I was proud of my anger. I was proud that I said exactly what I wanted when I wanted. Well, maybe I didn't. You know, many of my sisters kind of, they didn't get angry. So they got asthma instead and things. I mean, they at least didn't harm people. But I might have been very, you know, upfront and straightforward, how very kind. I didn't make myself crazy. I just made everybody else crazy. You know? So at least. So then, okay, then I heard Buddhism, and Buddhism told me that I could look at my own mind. It was a brand new idea to me. I'd never heard of such a thing. But I was happy to do that. But it took me, even intellectually, I liked the teaching. Intellectually, it really was empowering for me to hear Buddha's view that anger and jealousy and blah and blah are not at the core of our being. This, I find, is a profound teaching, and it's massive in Buddhism. And we've got to really take that on board. Intellectually, I was very moved by that, and that gave me courage. But it took me years of hard work, hard practice, before I can remember even the moment, years after I became a Buddhist, when for the first time I got some real inner confidence that anger wasn't my middle name. So it does just take time, but when we can have the view that it's possible, I can achieve it, we will persevere. But this is where what she's talking about is this frantic, junkie, attachment's a junkie that only can bear the nice things and can't stand the ugly things. So we've got to be brave. That's what being patient means. Patience is like being brave in the face of that rubbish and the dramas. It's okay. I can handle it, you know, and we can. We can. We can change. Our mind is utterly flexible. And the reason it's hard is because it's just a bunch of boring old habits, that's all. And we know habits we can change. So it needs perseverance and confidence is the real thing I'm saying here. And the other one of attachment's got multifaceted. It's a junkie that only wants the nice things. But its energy is dissatisfaction. So no matter what we get, the best cake, the best body, the best everything, it's still never enough. It's still not right. And that's what we're addicted to. We're addicted to always finding the fault, which means never being satisfied with what we've achieved. It's sort of like you've just accomplished grade one, and you're completely depressed because, oh, I'm not at grade two. Then you get grade two, oh my God, I'm not at grade three. And you get to grade 470,000, oh, I'm not at grade 470,001. This is dissatisfaction. It's easy to say, delight that you've done grade one, but it's deadly serious. And then you have courage to go to grade two, because you're enthusiastic about it. So it's like, and the thing is, because we feel that I'm no good because I've only got grade one, we believe it's true. We've got to stop believing our own script. We've got to write a new script, and I'm not joking. Buddha's like a cognitive therapist. He is a cognitive therapist. Change your thoughts. So don't push, you can't just push away the negative thought sometimes. So what you do is you add a positive thought on top. If you can't keep saying, you can't stop saying, oh, I'm so bad, I haven't achieved this. You say, well, I've achieved that, I'm doing okay. You just got to write scripts, you know, in your head. And then if you think something often enough, you get used to it and it becomes a real experience. This is not joking, you know. But because it feels true, we believe it's true. Are we communicating? So doing your nine round breathing, doing a bit of focusing, these are simple little lovely cute little techniques that won't in themselves do magic. They're not special magic pills. They're just giving yourself a bit of space so you can do the real job of working with your thoughts, dealing with them, because then what comes out your mouth will be reasonable. I use this example about my own family. Just recently, it's really struck me, you know. I've got 6 siblings, all very close in age. 6 sisters and a brother. We're all intense, we all talk fast, we're all speedy, we're all like whatever, you know, it doesn't matter. Whatever. Except my brother. He's the youngest, he's kind of cool. Just the girls, whatever. The point is, we were brought up, we weren't very rich, so we had to share beds. My mother had so many babies so quickly she didn't keep up with getting the money, you know. So we had to share beds and rotate. And so it was like a nightmare. It was shrieking and yelling and fighting. And 2 kids had asthma and I used to argue and punch everybody. I was such a bully, you know. Because everyone was feeling like lack of space, you know. My poor mother didn't realize that was the problem. So what I'm saying is this. As we got older and we all went off our own lives, we'd come back at Christmas time. We were very good friends, you know. And then we'd fight again. So all the pain that I talked to Polly about Julie and then Janet about Tony and Mary about Judy, you know, and blah, blah, blah. You build up all these dramas in family. You know, then you start, and because we all believe everything we ever hear, this unhappiness starts to come, you know. Then you've got to solve the problem and forgive each other and it's all the pain. Well, the last many years, I would say, somehow there's become this unspoken agreement between us. We never say bad things about each other to each other. We just don't do it. And we never talk about things we don't agree with when we're together. So, consequence, we are really harmonious. We have a gorgeous time when we're together. We love each other very much. But we have learned to accept each other's differences, and there are huge differences, I promise you. Do you understand? It's been extraordinary to see it. And I really think it's amazing. Speech, we never even think about speech. We don't go to prison for bad speech. We mostly don't hit each other and kill each other, but our speech is the nightmare. And we think it's normal just to go blur. Do you understand? Because we feel safe, especially behind backs. But this is what does all the disharmony. And guess what it does to you? This is the point that we just don't see in our culture. And this is the Buddhist point, fundamental point. Buddha, like Jesus and like your grandma, says don't kill, don't lie, don't steal, don't this and don't that. But the reason Buddha says it is because it's going to harm you, baby. So when we can really see that my angry words, my jealous words, my bad mouthing behind backs, my gossiping destroys me, it all does is stir up my misery. So forget about trying to meditate. If your mouth's uncontrolled, don't even bother trying to meditate. It's like you're just going against the wind, you know. You go 4 steps up and 27 back. It's impossible because you're stirring up your misery when you say negative words. And many of our words are negative, even though we think we're being nice. We love to talk about people behind their backs. We can't wait to get home to the hubby and the kids talking about the mean, ugly colleague at work. We can't wait to talk about that sister to this sister. We can't wait to talk about the hubby to the auntie. I mean, we're our own enemies, you know, with our speech. And we really don't realize we're harming ourselves. Forget about the harm you do to other people. This is something, talk about meditating. This is a profound spiritual practice, I tell you. You should, even like one of my friends, a good lovely Buddhist, a sweet girl, whose mother was off doing this and that, and the girl had a baby, and she was brokenhearted that her mummy wasn't coming and sharing the baby with her. She said she was missing out, you know, the grandma, you know? And she'd always complain and talk to the husband. They were so sad together. She'd go on and on about it. She couldn't sleep. She was distressed. What can I do? I said, well, give it a month and make a decision that you will never say one bad word about your mother to your husband, just between the two of them. The change was miraculous. Do you understand? So don't worry about meditating, honey. Just control your speech. You see my point? And I don't mean be like Pollyanna. I mean, watch your mind. You've got to watch your mind like a hawk. And to refrain from saying the bad thing behind backs, and that includes talking about Mr. Trump. I've talked about Mr. Trump. But if you do talk about Mr. Trump, try and be wise and not just angry the whole time, because you're poisoning yourself. Do you understand? I mean, we think it's a virtue to criticize politicians all day. All you're doing is stirring up your own distress and your own anger. Please see that. See the disadvantage to yourself. Not to, and the families especially. The families are a minefield. And work and families are the nightmares. So make a decision. Make a decision to even give it a day at a time. You'll be amazed how good your meditation will be. Are we communicating?
Yeah.
Good. That'll do. It's only 8:20, but I'm not going to leave any meditations. That's your advice. Control your speech. We all know these things. They always say, if you're going to say anything about someone, say something nice. Kind of, oh yeah, you know. So boring, so corny, you know, isn't it? But families, I mean, you hear the disasters in families, the nightmares of the breaks in families, people's hearts broken, they stop talking, divisions like two wars, like armies in families. It's unbearable, you know. Yes. What's we turn?
My turn.
You go on. You talk. You got.
She's got a mic.
Oh, okay.
It's on.
Okay, good, darling. Talk to me.
I was gonna ask about the truth and how do we know what is true? And you mentioned just the facts, like stick with.
Okay,
the facts.
I know. Oh my God. At 8:20. Okay.
You can be succinct.
Okay, I'll tell you what it means. Okay.
It's just in the moment.
I know. No. Not like that. Yeah, sort of like that, but not like that. Okay. Forget the bigger picture in Buddhism, but if we just look at the all these unhappy emotions we're talking about, we all recognize these, don't we? And we listen to our voices, they're just the voices in our head before they get to the mouth, isn't it? That's all. And they're called anger. They're called jealousy. They're called fear. They're called low self-esteem. They're called these things. Are they not? So forget the bigger picture in Buddhism about karma, all this business, about how things exist and the wisdom teachings, which are really vast. Forget all that business. The point that Buddha's making is this. I said it before and I'll say it again. Is that one component, which we all know, of these unhappy emotions is the disturbance, the pain of it. They're extremely disturbing, aren't they? Would you agree with that? The other point that he's making, and we discussed this yesterday, and this is really hitting it on the head when it comes to Buddha's real view of the universe. He says that the problem is that the component they have is that they're all distorted conceptual stories. So if I've got strong attachment for a piece of chocolate cake. Attachment means I'm feeling needy, there's something missing, what is it, I haven't got enough, oh, chocolate cake, and then you see that brown triangle, and then you make this big, there's this big story in your head about what it is. Would you agree with that? And there's a big story about what the cake's going to do for you when you eat it, which means it's going to make me happy. Would you agree with that in general? Well, Buddha's saying it's a great big rotten lie. It isn't true. Chocolate cake is not the cause of your happiness. That boyfriend you're completely in love with, or the person who's going to completely be the end of all your story, and I've finally found happiness, and I'm going to be together till we're 80, and he's the person, the cause of all my happiness, and all my blah, 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 blah. This is Buddha's, what he's saying is, all these emotions, that's one example, attachment, they are gross inflations of the truth. That's all he's saying. And in Buddhist literature, this goes to profound degree of analysis. And this is really the key to being a Buddhist in this way, learning to first subdue the emotional component, not suffocating, and not making yourself like a flatlining, boring person. No. But the more you do this process of becoming familiar with all these thoughts and emotions and feelings, the more you gradually sort them out and deconstruct and analyze and deconstruct all these seeming emotions, but then you get to the conceptual level, which is beneath them, which is what informs them. You're then able to really do this deeper analysis of the anger and analyze the actual story that anger is telling you. He is the cause of all my suffering. How dare he do this? He is so evil. And we all know when we calm down, we realize it wasn't as bad as we thought. Very often, would you agree with that? When you're really angry, it looks huge, doesn't it? Look at a child being angry. It's like they're having a serious mental breakdown, aren't they? You are the cause all my suffering. I'm going to kill myself. And then 5 minutes later, they're cracking jokes again. So we just go, oh, he was angry for 5 minutes. But excuse me, he had a serious psychotic break. For 5 minutes, he was psychotic. Would you agree? If you think about it. But we're so used to it. That was a completely grotesque over-exaggeration of the problem, wasn't it? His sister just looked at him wrongly. Are you sort of hearing what I'm saying? Can you not see that that's not true? That he didn't, it wasn't true what he was seeing. Can you see that? Well, Buddha takes that and runs profoundly deep with it, to the point where he says, using this concentration, delving deep into this whole cognitive process, which is our thoughts and feelings and emotions, not the brain, not going to your therapist and sorting out who caused it, which is what we do in the West, looking like for a needle in a haystack, what happened to me when I was 4 years old that caused me to be so angry. Buddha gets us, using these amazing skills, to go into the actual cognitive process itself of the anger, to unpack and unravel it, and get to realize that you're completely over-exaggerating. So I can say over the years, one thing I can be proud of for my hard work, being a Buddhist, I can say with certainty that the extreme, volatile, up-and-down emotional component that I had that was called anger was up and down like a yo-yo every day when I didn't get what I wanted, because that's what anger is. Because I've worked on my mind and done this job that I'm talking about, I can say with absolute certainty that the things that would have made me completely crazy literally don't make me angry anymore, because I've changed my interpretation of them. Because anger is an interpretation. Attachment is an interpretation. So I've fundamentally changed my interpretation of things. So my mind is peaceful. That's the Buddhist approach. Does this make sense at all? You don't look like you're really convinced. You get it. So there's other stuff he talks about, what is true and what is not. But this is the major part of it. So the consequence of changing your mind the way Buddha talks is, you're not suppressing emotions. But I'm just as volatile as I was when I was little. Listen to me. I'm probably more volatile. Do you understand? I'm still talk fast and, you know, like this. But I can say, without trying to show I haven't got realizations, but I can say I've done this work and do this work every day. So my mind is more stable, more clear, therefore more forgiving, more wise, more understanding of other people, because we're all in the same boat, honey. It is hard work. It's the hardest work I've ever done in my life. And the Buddhist approach is very sophisticated in a sense, because it's not about the brain, and it's not about dealing with what mummy did when you were seven. It's dealing with the actual cognitive process itself that informs those emotions, because they're just the tip of the iceberg. So it's really long term and hard work. But you know, and then of course when you get concentration in meditation, your mind gets unbelievably more crystal clear and unbelievably more capable of doing this deep analysis and unpacking and unraveling and fundamentally changing your view of the universe to the point where you'd have no attachment, no anger, no jealousy, but have enormous joy and clarity and love and compassion. And it's just a cognitive process, nothing mystical. It's not mystical. It's not magic. It's hard, hard inner work. Are we communicating?
Yes.
Okay. That'll do. So whether you become a Buddhist, I don't care. But do this job. Take responsibility. Have respect for yourself, I beg you. Every one of us has all this potential right in us this millisecond. Everything is in there. We have to be the one to find it. And then we can do it for ourselves, which is the wisdom wing. We can then see everybody else is in the same boat. And we will have such compassion and such kindness and such courage to deal with the dramas of life, you know. Okay, so never give up, please. And follow your own path. Find the techniques that work for you. Don't get nervous about what other people think. You have integrity, especially when you're in cultures where you're really, you know, like Asian, Indian cultures. Excuse me, we used to be that way too, the old white people, but now we're so degenerate. But Indians, I mean, there's a strong thing of family, the tyranny of family, isn't it? My God, keep away from the tyranny of family. And all you try to do in your life is do what you think you're supposed to do. Do what you think you've got to do. Don't worry what your mummy thinks and daddy thinks and grandpa think. That's very courageous, I tell you. Follow your own heart. Have courage. Make your own decisions. Even if nobody ends up liking you, it doesn't matter. That I'd say for sure. Are we communicating here?
Yes.
The tyranny of family is too much, I think. We think it's fantastic to have family. It is. But there can be absolute tyranny, and we can be living suffocated all our lives worrying what mummy thinks and daddy thinks and grandma thinks and grandpa thinks, and we're so convinced that I couldn't possibly do that because you just don't do it in our family. Well, excuse me, have the courage. Look at India. Mr. Buddha was an Indian. He left his entire kingdom. Don't just think of it as romantic. Don't think of it as history. A real human being had the courage to give up everything to find the truth, to find reality, to find himself so he could help others. So have courage. Be brave. Follow your own heart. Do not be scared of what people think. This is huge. This is our deepest attachment of all. The deepest attachment we have is to what other people think of us. And we will be craven all our lives trying to make sure they like us. This is our worst attachment, our worst suffering. Believe me. We've been desperately trying to make mummy happy since we're born. We can give her our blood. She still won't be happy. So you have to have the courage to do what's right. We've got to look in deep to find out what's right, and then we follow it. Even if no one approves, it doesn't matter. This is our worst attachment, worse than sex and drugs and everything. Attachment to what people think. The deepest one, the deepest cause of our suffering. The voice that's inside us all day, worrying what they're thinking. But I shouldn't do this because he said this, and I shouldn't do that because they said that, and I must do this, and I better not do this. So much fear because of this one. This is the deepest one, so hard to see. But if we can have the courage, we need to become our own person, become our own person, you know, and follow our own heart, and do what's right for the long term. You'll be so happy with yourself. And then you'll become your own marvelous person.
Chang chub, sem chug, rinpoche, ma ke panam ke gyu chig, ke pa nyam pa, me pa yang gong ne gong du, hava shok.
Okay. Thank you.
May we read our sponsor dedication?
Yeah, go. Absolutely.
Okay. Jill Marie and Miranda Benson.
Can you say it a bit louder so people know what you're thinking? Tell them what you're thinking them for. They don't know anything.
Okay.
Okay.
Their dedication, may everyone have the resources to meet the teachings in this life and all future lives, and may these teachings move our hearts toward the Dharma in new ways so that our bodhisattva attitude is awakened and we can be the cause for the future enlightenment of all beings everywhere.
So who's saying that?
Jill Marie and Miranda Benson.
Okay, you've got to explain who Jill Marie are and what they've done and why they're saying that. People don't know about your sponsorship business. Tell them. They have a system in this center where they offer all the teachings free. What happened?
I can't do it. There it is. Everything's offered free, and so then people every night decide they'd like to sponsor a certain teaching. They give money to help the center. They write a little dedication. So Jill Marie and who?
Miranda Benson.
And Miranda have decided to sponsor tonight. That's their little dedication. And they have kindly offered money to support the center. That's what they do about sponsorship. Every night it happens like that. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
That's what you should tell them. Keep going.
And Louise Miller, to the long lives of our precious teachers.
There you go.
Thank you.
Thank you, Louise. Thank you, Jill Marie. And thank you who?
Miranda.
On behalf of Kadampa Center.